This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. It's all over but the counting, I think. A little bit of political business today, also the business of French fries and some electric guitar as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday it is, November the 8th, Election Day. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This election has been trying. It's been trying for partisans. It's been trying for voters in the middle as well. It has, however, been pure, pure joy for Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC. Primetime ratings the past couple of weeks have surged as much as 140% from the same time last year. That's according to Nielsen. And with those ratings, of course, come profits. With the race coming to an end, Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York on what happens next for the cable news business.
Cable news companies live for presidential elections. The more controversial, the better. Eric Brannon follows the cable television business for IHS.
When you think about a news network, elections are, they're a gimme. So they are points where we can't, if we're a network executive, expect to see spikes in revenue.
But after the spike comes the downside when ratings crash. Neil Macker watches media companies for Morningstar.
As long as there's no controversy, they're going to come down tremendously.
And tremendously quickly. Just from October to December 2012, Nielsen data show the cablers lost as much as half their primetime audience. With that go the higher ad revenues channels were feasting on. Network executives have been warning that a decline is coming, but it's always important to remember with cable channels that advertising is just one revenue stream. Veteran TV news analyst Andrew Tindall.
The reason why the election years are important to these cable channels is that in these years, they prove themselves to be indispensable to a cable viewer.
That could give them more leverage in long-term talks to squeeze higher fees out of the cable companies which bundle up the channels and deliver them to homes. Both network leaders and Wall Street investors say cable news networks face individual challenges, but also some common ones. They need to do a better job of attracting younger viewers, whether on air or online, and they need innovative new programming that'll attract an audience when there is not a story as big or as infuriating as this election. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Equities had a decent day today, up all the way around. Could have been the election, could have just been trading, you know. Not loving life, however, was Hertz. Shares of its parent Hertz Global Holdings plunged 22% after the rental car company reported weak earnings and lowered its forecast. Hertz, which owns Dollar and Thrifty as well, said revenues dropped and it had to do a big write-down of the value of its fleet, all those cars. It is not at all what car rental companies need in the face of Uber and Lyft. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Rental car companies have to be really good at guessing the right fleet mix and depreciation rates for their cars. If not, they can get into trouble. That's what happened with Hertz, which made a big bet on compact cars, whose resale values came in lower than expected. Here's car rental industry consultant Neil Abrams.
So the dynamics of the aftermarket, the used car market, will affect the cost of the fleet, fleet being the single biggest expense in being in this business.
Abrams says Hertz's competitors, Enterprise and Avis Budget, are doing better. They're investing and expanding in new markets, but they're all facing stiffer competition from ride-sharing services.
Two quarters ago, we saw the ride-sharing economy eclipse rental cars.
Bob Nevue is president of Certify.com, which provides travel and expense management services to companies. His firm analyzed more than 10 million business traveler receipts and expenses and found that Uber and Lyft now account for 52% of ground transportation transactions. Car rentals make up just 36%. Nevue says business travelers are even choosing ride sharing for longer distances to eliminate the headaches of rentals.
Well, you think about a rental car return location. You know, a lot of times at an airport, they're off-site. You've got to get in a shuttle. All of the little challenges there are inefficiencies, really.
On the flip side, companies like Hertz and Enterprise are now renting cars to drivers at ride-sharing companies. But it's unclear how much that will make up for the loss of traditional customers. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The Wall Street story to think about really isn't today so much. It's tomorrow once all those votes are in. As for today, though, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The path to Brexit seems to be getting ever more complicated for British Prime Minister Theresa May. Today, the Scottish government called on Britain's Supreme Court to force May to consult with them. That's on top of the court ruling last week that May has to get the British Parliament to agree too. Some Brits who don't support leaving the European Union want to keep their options open. Among them are descendants of tens of thousands of German Jewish refugees who fled the Nazis and settled in Britain in the 1930s. They have the right to apply for German citizenship, and hundreds of them are. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Welcome to this commemoration marking Holocaust Memorial Day.
Every year on the anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp, Britain commemorates the victims of genocide.
We are all here to remember the 6 million Jews who were exterminated by the Nazis.
Remembering those horrors doesn't necessarily entail hostility today towards the country that perpetrated them. Oliver Marshall's grandmother lost many family members in the Holocaust, and yet he was happy to apply for German citizenship.
For psychological reasons, I wanted to continue to feel part of Europe.
Marshall, an academic, says this summer's vote for Brexit was a horrible shock for him and members of his immediate family.
To have our European citizenship taken away from us on a kind of a whim one day in June, it filled me with anger and it filled them with anger.
They're relieved they can now retain their European citizenship, having taken up German nationality. But what of their grandmother, now deceased, who lost many close members of her family to the Nazis?
Your grandmother, Clara, probably wouldn't have approved.
My grandmother, she hated Germans. I think she would have just not understood.
Some 400 descendants of German Jews who fled the Nazis and settled in Britain have applied for German citizenship following the Brexit referendum. Here at the Association of Jewish Refugees in London, Michael Newman has had dozens of inquiries about this, a curious twist of history.
One of the things the organisation did post-war was to help people become naturalised British. And here we are, 70 years later, passing on information about their descendants acquiring German citizenship. I mean, people can see the irony there.
But then Germany today is a totally different country, and reclaiming the lost citizenship has practical benefits. Just ask 28-year-old research scientist Sam Bowers. He got his German passport 2 months ago. It means that after Brexit, he'll retain the automatic right to live and work anywhere in the EU.
It is very valuable to have access to working in any of 27 different countries. So that really increases your options.
Especially important, he says, since, like many scientists, he fears his research funds in Britain might dry up after Brexit. He feels his new dual Anglo-German nationality makes perfect sense.
This is just a means of retaining my current identity as a citizen of Europe.
But not every descendant of Holocaust victims sees this Brexit avoidance strategy as just a prudent move.
My name is Harry Heber, and I came to the UK in December 1938.
Harry Heber arrived here from his native Austria as a 7-year-old Jewish refugee. Now 85, the retired optician regards himself as a very loyal British subject.
What is your reaction then, Harry, to this idea of the descendants of Jewish refugees applying for German or Austrian citizenship?
I think it's madness. The idea of going back to Austria, having been hounded out by the Nazis, is absolutely horrendous.
He claims that apart from Israel, Britain is the safest country on the planet for Jewish people. And anyway, he questions the need for European citizenship. He doesn't believe that Brits will have any serious trouble living or working in Europe after they leave the EU. But then he voted for Brexit. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This just in from the Marketplace desk of There Is No Such Thing as a Free Lunch. Tesla is going to stop offering free charging on its nationwide supercharger network of owners of its electric cars. Instead, the company is going to give new buyers the charging equivalent of 1,000 miles a year. After that, it's cash on the barrelhead. Quite a change from what had been a pretty sweet selling point. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains what's going on.
Tesla wasn't talking, except to say in a blog post, that the move is to encourage drivers to charge up at the stations on long trips instead of using them to charge all the time.
You do have a few people ruining it for everyone by misusing the system.
Ben Kalo is an analyst at Robert W. Baird. How much were the literal freeloaders saving? Terry O'Day is with EVgo, which has a network of fast charging stations for all vehicles, including Teslas. He says prices fluctuate according to demand.
But you might think of a 30-minute charging session to be in the neighborhood of $10 to $12.
Tesla has more than 700 supercharger stations around the world. The free charges were a selling point for the pricey luxury vehicles. But were they sustainable?
Free for everyone forever is not the typical model for most products, right?
Kalo says the model was a brand-building ploy and couldn't keep going with so many more Teslas hitting the streets. He doesn't see the loss of free charging as a turnoff for buyers.
Rather than focusing on how it can hurt demand, I think that you will ultimately have, as the network continues to be built out, you'll have people making the decision to buy a Tesla because they do have that infrastructure out there.
And charging for charging will make building out that infrastructure more possible. People who already own Teslas will still get to charge for free. If you were thinking of buying one, might want to move soon. Grandfathering ends after this year. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was almost as if the Beatles had hired an accordion player at the height of their success.
The electric guitar wasn't always cool, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 73 points on this election day, 0.4%, ended things at 18,332. The NASDAQ up 27 points, about 0.5%, 5,193. The S&P 500, 8 points to the good, 0.3%, 21.39. Priceline up 6.6%. Today, the online travel company announced better-than-expected earnings. Marriott International up 2.7% as the hotel group reported a jump in earnings and revenue. SeaWorld up 0.8%. The aquatic theme park operator said it had stopped the fall in visitor numbers that occurred after animal rights activists took on that company. Health-related stocks ailed just a tad. CVS Health discounted 11.8% today on news its third quarter revenues didn't meet expectations. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Now a story that really, well, it has nothing at all to do with this election, except maybe that it might fall under the heading of comfort food, because 2016, am I right? There is a growing community of home chefs who are using the internet to help sell their food. In this case, an entrepreneur in South Los Angeles who sells meals through Instagram. David Weinberg spent some time with a guy known as Mr. Fries Man.
To get my hands on Mr. Fries Man's French fries, I called the number posted on his Instagram account and placed an order. And then I got a text instructing me to drive to a parking lot in Gardena, a city that borders Los Angeles to the south. Park near the wall, the text said, and look for a gray Pontiac Grand Prix. I pulled into the lot, saw the Grand Prix, and asked the guy inside the car, "Are you Mr. Friesman?" He nodded and then reached into the back seat and pulled out a styrofoam container with my name written on it. This was the first time I'd ever bought French fries from a guy in a parking lot, and I had a lot of questions. Mainly, who is Mr. Friesman? And it turns out that the guy who handed me my order was not Mr. Friesman. The real Mr. Friesman is a guy named Craig Batiste.
My name is Craig. I'm Mr. Fryman. Everybody know that. I say hello.
One of the first things I learned about Batiste was his catchphrase.
Hello.
Which he uses as liberally as the lemon garlic sauce he drizzles on his best-selling menu item.
The most popular one is lemon garlic shrimp.
The business is run out of the small two-bedroom back house where Batiste, his fiancée Dorothy Morales, and their three kids live. Sunday through Thursday, Batiste works at Pepsi, where his shift starts at 3 a.m. After work, he heads straight home and starts cooking. Morales begins prepping at about 6 a.m., and after Batiste posts that day's menu on Instagram, the phone starts ringing.
Mr. Friesman. Okay, is this your first time ordering with us?
The menu changes often, okay, but there are always at least 5 meats and half a dozen sauces available. From these, Batiste makes dozens of combinations.
Buffalo shrimp, buffalo chicken, barbecue bacon ranch chicken, green chili enchiladas, teriyaki pineapple express shrimp fries, and it's not even all of them.
When they started selling fries about 7 months ago, business was slow. But then 2 things happened that changed everything. The first was the hashtag.
I started posting on Instagram, and one of my buddies, Devin, said, "Man, you got to use your hashtags, hashtags. That's going to get the followers up." I said, "Man, I don't believe in that crap." And I started doing it, and then next thing you know, followers started coming in. I said, "Oh, this is getting serious. Hello."
Craig would post a photo of some fries and add as many as 30 hashtags. Things like fries, best fries, good eats, great eats. And he'd tag foodie celebrities in the photos. As a result, people found him online. Craig also discovered he was part of a community of African-American home chefs who cross-promote each other's food through social media.
We all support each other. We had swap a plate out. "Man, you bring this when I got there. Man, you take these fries. What fries you want? What plate you want? You got this for the day?" Yeah, it's like a secret society, a food secret society.
And then on Thursday, September 8th, came the second big spike in Batiste's business when a rapper named Nipsey Hussle, who has more than 1 million followers on Instagram, shared one of Mr. Friesman's posts on his feed. Batiste's business took off. Mr. Friesman now has over 36,000 followers on Instagram. An order of fries costs between $11 and $24, depending on the number of toppings. The business averages $700 a day in gross profits. Not bad, considering Batiste has no labor costs. His friend William Barney, for example, helps out for free because he believes in Batiste's vision.
"And we just all having a good time. I feel like that's what life's about. You're supposed to be doing something that you love doing instead of stressing over things that you have no control over. You only live once. YOLO." Do they still say YOLO?
Batiste isn't making enough to quit his day job, but he's saving up, hoping to someday open his own place or possibly a food truck. Until then, if you want an order of fries, you'll have to drive down to Gardena and meet a guy in a parking lot. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
We're going to keep going with our election distraction strategy here for just a little bit. We're going to talk about something that's as American as apple pie, the electric guitar. There was a time when there were no electric guitars, when nobody had ever heard of Fenders or Gibsons. That's where Brad Tolinsky starts his new book. It's called Play It Loud. Brad, thanks for coming on the program.
Hey, Kai.
We have to start, I think, with a guy most people have probably never heard of, and his
command, really, coming out of regular acoustic guitars. His name is George Beauchamp, and he basically said to the folks he was working with, make it louder, right? He wanted regular guitars to be louder.
Yeah, I mean, when George was around in the 20s and 30s, the guitar had already been around for a couple hundred years. And it was a great instrument, but it had one real problem. It just wasn't loud enough. You'd put it up with other instruments, and whether it was a horn instrument, brass instrument, or a piano, those things would just kick its ass.
He comes out with this prototype. I mean, it's a circular kind of thing with a long neck. He calls it the frying pan, Beauchamp does. And this is sort of the first working model. You actually have a picture of the patent that he gets for this thing.
Pretty homely little instrument.
Yeah, it kind of was.
It actually looked like a frying pan. But the interesting thing about it is it doesn't really sound that much different than guitars do these days. Sounded pretty good.
This is one of those interviews that is screaming for a little sound, for a little audio. So I'm going to play some here, and then I want to talk about it. Charlie Christian, right? That was his name,
yeah.
The guy who played that?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about Charlie
mm-hmm.
Christian.
Well, in the 30s, Benny Goodman had a big band, and Benny was the equivalent of like the Beatles or Elvis at that time. And Goodman had this A&R sort of music advisor, this guy named John Hammond, who was pushing hard for this young musician from Oklahoma named Charlie Christian, 22-year-old. Mm-hmm. But there were two problems. Christian was black at the time when Jim Crow and segregation laws were still in full effect. Mm-hmm. And Benny Goodman, his band was white. And the second was that he played the electric guitar, which Goodman at that time considered to be at best a novelty.
Hmm.
Goodman decided that Christian's talent was just too monumental to ignore and, you know, did the smart thing, put him on radio. Christian overnight became a superstar. You know, it was the first time many, many people had even heard the electric guitar. I always said, it was almost as if the Beatles had hired an accordion player at the height of their success, you know. It was a real head turner.
Yeah, no, I bet. All right, here's some more sound. We're moving ahead a couple of decades here. Here you go. Jimi Hendrix in the Star-Spangled Banner. Completely different use of basically the same instrument, representing something else.
It was so interesting. He was a black man who dared to use his incredible technique to make this anti-war statement. And, you know, for people that were around at that time, you remember Muhammad Ali had also at that time resisted the draft. You know, Jimmy's statement was political. It was racial. And it was all driven by an electric guitar, not even vocals. You know, he did it all without saying a word.
Right. We could sit here and play clips all day. And we could play Eric Clapton and Eddie Van Halen and Pete Townsend and a whole bunch of people. The point you get to at the end of the book, though, is this. This is now, and this is your word, this is now a mature instrument, right? And it sells to collectors for unbelievable, the collector's items, sell to collectors for unbelievable amounts of money. Rock is a, and again, your word, a heritage genre kind of music. Where does the electric guitar go now, you know, going on 100 years after George Beauchamp?
Women guitar players. Women over the years, unfortunately, have been sort of marginalized or intimidated even in music stores. It's been sort of a guy's sport, if you will.
Huh.
And it's kept a lot of women from expressing themselves in that way. But you know, I live in Brooklyn, New York right now, and now when I go and see a band, it was unusual to see any women players, but almost every band that I see now, bands are sort of half and half, you know, 50% women, 50% men. That could represent, you know, the next decade. Through their lens, what's going to happen with this instrument?
Brad Tilinski was for many years the editor-in-chief of Guitar World magazine. He is now the author with his friend Alan DiPerna of a book called Play It Loud, An Epic History of the Style, Sound, and Revolution of the Electric Guitar. It's a fascinating read. Brad, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out. Lawyers for Donald Trump were in court in Nevada this afternoon arguing that early voting polling stations stayed open this past Friday night longer than they were supposed to. The campaign wants the ballots, or wanted, rather, the ballots and voting machines from those polling stations, as well as the names of poll workers, impounded and preserved. The judge was not sympathetic. She asked the campaign's lawyer how he would protect those poll workers from being harassed. Here's his answer.
There will be no harassment as a part.
How can you tell me that?
As a part.
How can you do you watch Twitter?
Well, yes, Your Honor, we do. 2016 right there is what that was. It is all over but the shouting, everybody. The Dow up 72 today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 27, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 rose 8 points, 0.3%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Madhavan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerr, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. All right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.